From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Reveal reporter Trey Bundy has been after a batch of secret documents for more than 2 years, and now he's closer to them than ever before. He's in a law office in San Diego and standing just a few feet from some of those documents.
Are they in this office?
Yes.
And can you show them to me?
No.
That's attorney Erwin Zalkin. He represents victims of childhood sexual abuse by members of a global religion, the Jehovah's Witnesses.
All I can really say is we have the documents. I can't say what's in them. I can't even reference how many of the documents, how much, numbers, or anything like that.
Erwin got the files as part of a lawsuit against the Jehovah's Witnesses. So while he can look at them, he can't show them to anyone else, not even the police.
We are really literally have to keep those under lock and key.
The Jehovah's Witnesses only turned them over on the condition that they remain secret. A judge agreed and ordered Erwin not to share them with anyone else. So here's why that's dangerous. You see, these files could contain information about thousands of child abusers within the Jehovah's Witnesses, predators living freely in communities across the country. So how has this religious group managed to keep these documents and the secrets they contain under wraps for almost 20 years? That's what Trey set out to learn. He picks up the story back in Erwin Zalkin's San Diego office. Before I get going, I should tell you that this episode deals with sexual abuse and might be disturbing for some listeners.
Come on in. Jose, why don't you have a seat? Let's talk about your case a little bit. Let's see where we're at.
Erwin is talking to one of his clients, Jose Lopez. As a kid, Jose was sexually abused by a Jehovah's Witness. They're combing through documents in a small, generic conference room at Erwin's office. They're discussing what could happen with Jose's case. Jose's in his 30s, and you can hear from his voice, he sounds anxious.
Yeah, Mr. Zalkin, I had a question. Yeah. What do you think is going to happen after the judge comes forward with her decision?
Yeah. Well, I think that that there's a good chance that the Watchtower is going to file an appeal.
The Watchtower. Yeah. You're going to hear us use that term a lot. That's the name the Jehovah's Witnesses have for their global headquarters in Brooklyn. Jose says a man named Gonzalo Campos abused him. Gonzalo was a Jehovah's Witness in San Diego. Jose says Gonzalo groomed him for abuse during Bible study sessions.
One time, he sat me in his lap and, you know, kind of showed me the book and was talking to me, socializing, you know, being friendly. That's how I really saw it, as him just, you know, just trying to be more close and friendly with me.
But it went much further. Gonzalo sexually abused Jose, who was 7 years old at the time. By the time this happened, Jehovah's Witness leaders already knew Gonzalo had been abusing kids. We know that because local elders admitted to it.
I just think they should have, the Watchtower or the organization, I think they should have contacted the authorities and, you know, had this guy behind bars.
But they didn't. Here's Erwin at a news conference about the case.
The Watchtower and its agents, elders of the congregation, its local congregation, Linda Vista, Spanish congregation of the Jehovah's Witnesses, knew that they had a dangerous child sexual predator within their organization.
And not only did they fail to call the police, they actually promoted Gonzalo to the position of elder after they learned about the abuse.
While at that time, that entire time frame, he was abusing at least 8 children that we know of.
Erwin knows the abuse happened because Gonzalo admitted to it during a court deposition back in 2011. We have a tape from that deposition. In it, the Jehovah's Witness lawyer is interviewing Gonzalo through an interpreter.
I had problems with for having tried to touch him inappropriately.
And when you say tried to touch him inappropriately, you mean in a sexual manner?
say
yes.
Okay. Did the elders talk to you after this incident had taken place?
I remember that they did.
So local leaders knew Gonzalo had abused kids. They reported that to Jehovah's Witness headquarters in Brooklyn, but not to the police. Years later, though, many of Gonzalo's victims did turn to Erwin Zalkin. He'd made news for taking on another religion over child sex abuse, the Catholic Church. Back in 2007, Erwin negotiated a $200 million settlement for more than 100 people abused by clergy. He started getting calls from people saying they had been abused in all sorts of institutions, like universities and the Boy Scouts. About a dozen of them came from ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. Erwin prepared to fight a new opponent in court.
When you, as a human being, see the amount of harm that abuse, particular sexual abuse, does to a child, it derails them for the rest of their life. It is an intrinsic, insidious injury that they will not get over. It will be with them forever, and it impacts them at every stage of their life, and it's horrible.
When he's not in court, Erwin looks more like a college professor than a lawyer. Slim, with glasses, wears jeans to work. He's soft-spoken when he's describing the intricacies of a case. But get him going on child abuse, and his voice drops like a sledgehammer, a perfect tool for cross-examining witnesses. Listen to him explain the way Jehovah's Witnesses handle child abuse.
Keep your mouth shut. Do not go to law enforcement. You come to us first. Don't you tell anybody. You never tell another congregant. You don't warn parents in the congregation. We'll decide what happens here.
Because the abuse isn't reported to police when it happens, most of the abusers are never prosecuted and never go to jail. That's because the statute of limitations has run out. The Jehovah's Witnesses' secrecy around child abuse is part of their religion. They say the Bible tells them to keep authorities in the dark about child abuse. This is probably a good time to explain more about this religion. Jehovah's Witnesses consider themselves Christian. Part of their faith is spreading the word of God to others, knocking on doors, warning people about Armageddon.
Sickness and death. Poverty and disaster. How could a loving God be responsible for all of this? What the Bible says may surprise you. It says, the evil one controls the whole world.
That's from one of their preachings. When they say evil one, they mean Satan.
The good news is, the Bible says things will not always be like this.
Armageddon is coming. To earn their place in the afterlife, Jehovah's Witnesses are taught to avoid the outside world. They don't vote or serve in the military, and they usually don't go to college.
Where can we find answers? What if the answers have been there all along in the Bible?
They say the Bible teaches them that child abuse is a confidential matter. We know this because we have their memos. They read like a mashup of corporate policy and Bible verse, and they tell elders to hide child sexual abuse from police. Here's what they tell them to do. First, when elders learn about abuse, they have to immediately call the Watchtower's legal department. No one else, not law enforcement, not other members of their congregations.
Written, demanded, commanded policy. Very different. The Catholic Church, it was this unwritten. It was, they called it viva voce, by voice only. They didn't have it written down anywhere. It was just understood. Here it's in writing. I mean, there's no question.
Second, when an elder learns of a child abuser in his congregation, he has to send a report to headquarters in writing.
And so these reports were to be prepared and sent to Watchtower in a sealed, specially marked, confidential blue envelope.
And that's what I'm after. These are the documents I've been stalking for 2 years. Almost two decades worth of records that show the names and whereabouts of what are likely thousands of child abusers across the U.S.
I think the fact that there are known, molesters that are participating in congregation activities where there are children involved and parents who aren't aware of that is a high-risk situation.
I actually got a hold of one of these documents a couple of years ago. It's a simple one-page form with 9 questions, exactly like the documents Irwin has now.
So, for example, they wanted to know, how long ago did he commit the sin? What was his age at that time? What was the age of the victim? Was it a one-time occurrence or a practice? If it was a practice, to what extent? How is he viewed in the community and by the authorities?
While Irwin was working on the Jose Lopez case, he got an idea. If he could get his hands on what's inside all of those blue envelopes, he might be able to show that his cases pointed to a massive cover-up. So he went to court to get the entire database of child abuse documents. This is where the Jehovah's Witnesses really dug in. First, they said the job of compiling the documents was too big for their offices to handle.
Honestly, Mr. Zalkin, the efforts that we've made up to this point is just trying to figure out how on earth we could ever do that in our filing system.
That's Richard Ash, a senior Watchtower official. He wouldn't talk to me, but he had to talk to Irwin as part of a lawsuit. This is tape from that deposition.
You're talking about 14,400 congregations and over 3 million documents that have been scanned in that would have to be searched. It would take years to do that.
Irwin believed Richard was just making excuses to withhold the documents, so he brought in a software expert. That expert testified that the Watchtower should be able to search their files in as little as 2 days. The judge ordered them to produce the documents.
They refused. They just simply refused to do it.
The Jehovah's Witnesses fought the order all the way to the California Supreme Court.
And the Supreme Court, I mean, in a matter of days, just turned around and said, no, produce. They didn't. They defied the trial court. They defied the Court of Appeals. And they defied the California Supreme Court. They willfully refused to produce the documents.
This is not normal. A defendant in a lawsuit just flat out refusing an order that's been upheld by the state Supreme Court. So Irwin had a choice. He could ask the judge to hold the Watchtower in contempt of court, or he could go big and ask the judge for something called terminating sanctions. That's where the judge throws one side out of court and decides the case solely on the evidence of the other side.
In other words, we win, period.
Irwin's plan worked, and the judge awarded Jose Lopez $13.5 million. Irwin talked to reporters about the decision.
Documents that go back decades that shows the depth and the breadth of their knowledge of child predators within their organization, child molesters within their organization. They refused to produce those documents. And for that reason, they were sanctioned by this court and their defense was terminated.
I mean, obviously they're appealing that.
They did appeal that.
But still, that's a lot of risk. They're risking $13.5 million not to produce these documents.
Right. Yeah, they did. They took that risk.
And it's a risk they took again in Irwin's next case. This time, it cost them $4 million.
They've made a business decision not to produce these documents. And that case got terminated, too. And it's on appeal.
It looked like this was their game plan. Hide the child abuse files at any cost. If necessary, pay millions of dollars in judgments, but don't let anyone see the documents. Then, something kind of unbelievable happened. The Jehovah's Witnesses gave in. In Irwin's next case, they agreed to hand over the documents. They'd finally cracked, and Irwin would get the files. But when they started rolling in, something was wrong. The names of all the alleged abusers were blacked out. And Irwin only got 4 years of documents. There were another 15 years he was supposed to get. He went back to the judge, who demanded that the Jehovah's Witnesses turn over all the documents with the names. They refused, and the court ordered them to pay a fine of $4,000 a day until they comply. It's crazy to think that an organization hiding crimes against children could just thumb its nose at the courts like this, but so far, the Jehovah's Witnesses have gotten away with it. They're a multi-billion dollar corporation, so maybe millions in damages doesn't scare them.
I think that on some level, they're aiding and abetting these perpetrators. It's a public safety issue. I mean, at this point, this needs to be investigated.
Irwin isn't giving up, but he has hit a wall. This is a guy who for years has wanted nothing more than to expose the Jehovah's Witnesses child abuse files. And now that he's finally got some of them, he's legally bound to hide them from the public, from me. A while back, he called me after work to tell me how his cases were going. He said it was getting to him that he was sitting on so much horrible information, so many documents describing the abuse of children. He sounded tired.
It's frustrating. It's very frustrating to have seen what I've seen and to know what is going on in this institution, in this organization. It's very frustrating when I've got a gag in my mouth, you know. It's pretty hard. You know, we're trying our best to expose this truth. And they're doing everything they can to interfere with that effort, you know, to block that effort.
Right now, Irwin has 18 lawsuits pending against the Jehovah's Witnesses, and he's back in court on the Jose Lopez case. An appeals court ruled that the judge should not have kicked the Jehovah's Witnesses out of court without trying a less extreme method for getting the child abuse documents. Irwin still wants those files, and so do we. We'll get back to that later in the show, but first, how can a religion with 8 million members keep everyone quiet about child abuse?
I had been told through the whole proceedings, don't speak of this, it's a confidential matter. The congregation doesn't need to know this, and if you talk about it, that's grounds for disfellowshipping.
What disfellowshipping means, and how the Jehovah's Witnesses use it, when we come back on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey there, Julia B. Chan here, Reveal's digital editor. It's that time again when we start looking back at the year behind us and start making lists. Right now, I'm working on collecting people's favorite stories and moments from Reveal. And that includes you. We want to hear from you, the person listening to us right now. Which of our stories really affected or outraged you this year? Was there a scene that you just can't shake, a moment that stuck with you? We want to hear it. Go to revealnews.org/fave, that's F-A-V, to tell us about the time Reveal made you stop and listen. Again, that's revealnews.org/fav.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. For the past 2 years, Reveal reporter Trey Bundy has been trying to break through the wall of secrecy built up by the Jehovah's Witnesses. The group collects and maintains a database that could contain the names of thousands of child abusers. We haven't found one single case where the leaders of the religion have reported even one of those allegations to the police. So what happens to those children when they do come forward, often years later when they're adults? Trey went to McAllister, Oklahoma, to meet 47-year-old Debbie McDaniel. She says a Jehovah's Witness elder abused her from age 8 to 13, and when she was older, he kicked her out of the congregation. It's called disfellowshipping. When that happens, you're dead to the Jehovah's Witnesses. Everyone shuns you, even your closest family members. And it's that threat of shunning that keeps people from reporting child abuse. But not Debbie. She came forward with her story. Here's Trey.
Debbie grew up in Houston. Her dad, Wendell Marley, worked for NASA, and by all accounts was a brilliant engineer.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
He helped design and build the spacecraft that put Neil Armstrong on the moon.
That's one small step for man.
But then one day, he gave it all up.
When he met Jehovah's Witnesses and thought he had found the true religion and the world was ending any time, he just walked away from his career.
Wendell moved Debbie and the rest of the family to McAlester, Oklahoma, where he quickly rose through the ranks at the local Kingdom Hall. That's the place of worship for Jehovah's Witnesses. Wendell became the number two guy, and the number one guy was an elder named Ronnie Lawrence.
I was introduced to Ronnie as somebody quite Christ-like. People revered him.
But Debbie told me when she was 8 years old, Ronnie started abusing her. The abuse went on for 5 years. She didn't tell anyone about it, but she did get angry. She told me how when she was a teenager, she started drinking and having sex. When Ronnie found out about it, he decided to disfellowship her for sexual immorality. At that point, Debbie told her mom for the first time that Ronnie had abused her.
I said, well, I find it funny that the man who messed with me my whole life, my whole childhood, is now in a position to disfellowship me from the organization. And my mom was furious, livid. She said, you're going to lie about this man of God now? She said, you're just trying to get him back for disfellowshipping you for your wrongdoing. And I thought, you know, they're never going to believe me.
Being thrown out of the congregation was terrifying for Debbie, like it is for many witnesses. She was completely isolated from her friends and family. She thought her eternal soul was on the line.
Just trying to adjust to life outside the organization was too much for me, and I just wanted back in.
To get back in, she had to write a letter of apology to the elders, including Ronnie. She was also dealing with something else. She knew she was a lesbian, but she had to bury that part of herself. She married a witness and had a kid. She threw everything she had into the organization.
Door to door, study for the meetings, make every meeting. I was going to be the best Jehovah's Witness I could be.
A decade passes, and other people in Debbie's congregation have started to come forward, saying Ronnie abused them too. I've looked at letters from elders to the Watchtower, and they show that Ronnie was disfellowshipped, but he repented and was welcomed back on the condition that he name all of his victims and write them letters of apology.
So he says, Debbie, I humbly want to apologize for the hurt and pain I have caused you and for denying it. I have truly sinned against you, Jehovah, and the congregation. I betrayed the trust.
It was hard for Debbie to be around him, and she worried about other kids in the congregation. She says the elders told her to drop it and keep quiet.
Because I had been told through the whole proceedings with Ronnie, don't speak of this, it's a confidential matter. The congregation doesn't need to know this, and if you talk about it, that's grounds for disfellowshipping.
Eventually, Debbie couldn't take it anymore. She left her marriage and was disfellowshipped again, this time for coming out as gay. And that's when the shunning got really bad. Her daughter, Marley, was 12 years old and got caught in a nasty custody battle between her parents. Marley says her dad and Debbie's family coached her on what to say in text messages to her mom.
Yeah, they used to sit me down and actually tell me what to say or text me something and say just to copy and paste it and send it to her.
This text message came from Marley, and she said, you want to know why I'm devastated? I lost my mother, my best friend. You turned to Satan, and you're going to die.
I thought that there would come a point when God would judge us all, and then, and Mom would be basically destroyed. That's what I've heard my whole life.
The shunning and harassment got so intense that Debbie finally went to the police about it. Her whole story came pouring out. The police had never been informed about Ronnie's abuse of children. They started an investigation, and there was a hearing. And at that hearing, Debbie says, the shunning continued. She remembers going into the courtroom, and her parents were sitting behind Ronnie, on his side.
They wouldn't look my direction. Even when I was speaking on the stand, I looked out, and my mother and dad wouldn't look at me in the face.
The charges against Ronnie Lawrence were dismissed because of the statute of limitations. But court records and letters from McAlester elders to the Watchtower back up Debbie's story. Ronnie is still a Jehovah's Witness.
Hello, Mr. Lawrence?
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Trey Bundy.
I went to his house to see him.
But there are a lot of people in this town that believe that you did commit these crimes.
What do you want me to say?
I wanted to tell you whether I want you to tell me whether you committed these crimes.
No, I didn't, but that's all right. You're not going to blame me, neither will anyone else. So.
Well, there's a lot of documentation. Why did you write letters of apology if you didn't commit these crimes?
It had to do with several things, but I...
Was a part of it getting back into the organization? Was that part of the condition of coming back to the organization?
Debbie has built a new life, but she keeps a permanent record of the past.
My daughter, Marley, was so attached to the organization, and so I did a tattoo of her with holding a maze behind her, and it felt like she was trying to come out of the organization, but the maze was the organization, and she was hanging on to it, so I added that.
But Marley has come out of the organization. She and Debbie have reunited, and they live together now. But since they've become close again, the witnesses have started to shun Marley, too.
Well, obviously, all my friends were... a couple years ago were all Jehovah's Witnesses, and so I've lost pretty much all of them, and then the rest of my family has pretty much blocked me on social media, things like that. You can't leave and not be deemed mentally diseased, I guess. So something has to be wrong with you. I have to make up something.
Debbie and Marley have experienced what it's like to be shunned by the Jehovah's Witnesses. But the religion also shuts out the world at large, which makes it tough to find out how they operate. But Trey's been trying to figure that out. So he went to their headquarters in Brooklyn, New York, what they call the Watchtower.
Hello, this is Trey.
Okay.
Hi. Hi, who am I speaking with? Hey, Bryce, how you doing?
Trey's in the lobby of the Watchtower, talking to Bryce, a public relations guy there. He wouldn't even come down to talk to him.
This is my third trip out here. You know, I've been sending you guys emails and phone calls for a long time.
He's asking to interview someone from the governing body. They're the seven men who run the religion. Together, they're the equivalent of the Pope in the Catholic Church.
You know, this has been more than a year that I've been trying to contact somebody from the governing body, get some type of interview, get any type of Watchtower official to say anything on the record about this issue. And, you know, to be frank, it kind of amazes me that Jehovah's Witnesses aren't willing to express their own outrage that the Watchtower is shielding child sexual abusers from exposure or prosecution. Am I wasting my time by trying to get your side of the story?
Even after decades of child abuse allegations around the world, these guys won't acknowledge the problem. This is one of the most insular religions in the world. They don't want their members to go to college or even watch mainstream media. We wanted to know more about who they are and how they operate. So we asked a former insider to be our guide.
In my family, it was the only religion that was viewed as the right religion. It was the truth. We called it the truth.
Howie Tran is 40 years old now. He lived and worked at the Watchtower headquarters in Brooklyn for 7 years, starting when he was a teen. Trey tells us how he got there and why he eventually left.
Howie grew up in rural Arkansas in a poor family of Jehovah's Witnesses. He was always a small kid, and he would get bullied a lot. Things got worse when he turned 14. His parents split, and that's also when his mom discovered something he was hiding.
I come home from school, and my mom is visibly upset, and I find out that she discovered my porno magazine under my bed.
And it wasn't just that his mom found porn. It was the kind of porn she found, of naked men.
This could be nothing worse that can happen to a 14-year-old closeted gay kid from the Ozark Mountains than your mother to discover that you have homosexual tendencies. And I'm just, I'm mortified. I'm so ashamed. And I just immediately break down in tears.
Howie's mom was mortified too. She drove him to his grandmother's house. His uncle, who was an elder in the local Jehovah's Witness congregation, was also there.
And my shame is laid bare. The magazine is there, and yes, I took it. Yes, I hid it. I tried to hide it.
The family told Howie that his homosexuality was a sickness, a spiritual disease.
Now, that's the idea, that if I applied myself, I could overcome this. I could cure myself of this problem.
Howie's uncle suggested that he could stop fantasizing about men by using a calendar to track how often he masturbated.
And on that calendar, you would mark when you relapsed, and then hopefully the amount of days between that relapse and the next relapse would be greater. It always had to be greater. And of course, you always hope that the last time is the last time. But of course, it never was.
Howie believed being gay was an unforgivable sin.
I felt that I was corrupted. I felt that there was something terribly wrong with me. I was ashamed. I wished I was dead. I wished I was dead. You don't know how much I wished I could have killed myself. I did. I sat once on the floor in my bathroom with a bottle of bleach, and I tried my best to get myself to drink that damn bottle of bleach. That's the truth. But I couldn't. I was a coward. I couldn't kill myself. Because if you kill yourself, that's an unforgivable sin too.
Instead, Howie immersed himself in the religion. He was ready to do anything that would put him in God's good graces.
I wanted to be a pioneer because pioneers were the spiritual people in the congregation. They were the ones that were devoting themselves to the preaching work. And the preaching work was what God, what Jehovah God wanted you to do.
So in 1995, with his family's encouragement, he applied to live and work at headquarters, what Jehovah's Witnesses call Bethel, the house of God. If he got accepted, he would devote all of his time and labor to Jehovah, maybe for the rest of his life.
And I remember being so happy when I got my letter. And we warmly welcome you to the regular pioneer ranks. I made it. I was in the ranks.
There was no greater honor for a Jehovah's Witness. Howie was just 19 when he said goodbye to his mother and left for New York City. But when he got to Bethel, he realized that spiritual cleansing was going to take a lot of work.
There it is. Hillside Park is on that side, too.
I meet up with Howie in Brooklyn so he can show me around Bethel. As we walk around the street, he tells me what it's like for people who live and work here.
So it's cleaning, it's construction, it's the printing, it's working in the on the presses, it's working cleaning the presses, it's working in the kitchen to prepare the food, it's working in the laundries and during the heat and the large loads of laundry and doing the work.
Bethel's not a closed-off compound. It's a collection of buildings spread throughout Brooklyn Heights, prime real estate right along the East River.
We see the Statue of Liberty. We see the beautiful skyline, that picturesque skyline with the new Freedom Tower. We see all the beautiful brownstones that are now worth millions and millions of dollars. This was my neighborhood. This was my home. This is where I lived. I felt so fortunate.
So this is the nerve center of a multi-billion dollar nonprofit corporation, a global real estate venture, a massive publishing operation, and a religion with 8 million members around the world. To keep the machine running, the Jehovah's Witnesses depend on the unpaid labor of young followers. They're called Bethelites.
This is not a place for children. Never has been. It is only intended, Bethel is intended to just get the work done, and there's just no facility for children. So that has been a big cause for couples to have to leave. And it is a risk you take. Obviously, the Bethel doctor prescribes contraceptives for all the sisters because nobody wants to have to go home because of having a child.
The Bethelites live in dormitory-style housing, and they sign a vow of poverty. The religion takes care of their basic needs. For a neighborhood with 3,000 Jehovah's Witnesses, we really haven't seen many of them on the street. That's when Howie tells me that this is intentional.
And then that building is connected by tunnel to the 107 Columbia Heights building. And it's connected by tunnel to the 124 Columbia Heights building. All these are connected by underground tunnels.
Howie says they built the tunnels in part to hide their numbers and the fact that they'd bought up so much of the neighborhood. I'm looking at all these huge buildings and empty sidewalks and imagining a kind of subterranean ant farm below us. Howie had been at Bethel for a year and a half, working menial jobs, still marking that calendar, and hiding his sexuality from everyone. That's when the governing body approached him to ask for his help. Most of the leaders there were in their 80s or 90s and needed help with basic things like walking and reading their mail. For Howie, it was an enormous, almost unbelievable honor. He slips into character as he tells me about handing out Bible literature with one of the men, Carl Klein.
And he said to me, "I can walk, but people, if you're in a wheelchair, they listen." And he said, "So we'll take the wheelchair and we'll have better success."
On weekends, Howie would wheel Klein around a neighborhood promenade.
We'd approach someone and he would just push a magazine in their face, and then they would accept it or not. Sometimes he would put a little more effort into it, and if they said, "I don't want none of this," "Why not? Why don't you want it? It means everlasting life. Don't you want to live?" And they were like, "Get out of my face." Well, you know, you believe. It sounds awful now. I mean, looking back, of course, but you believe. You believe in the work. I believed that the work we were doing was important, that it was life-saving. And Armageddon, the end of the world, the tribulation is imminent. It's going to happen any moment now. And the only people to survive are going to be Jehovah's Witnesses, period. Nobody else.
Howie and I are about two blocks from the main Watchtower building when he spots someone, a member of the governing body.
That's Toni Morris. Go get him.
Now, I've sat in Morris's lobby and called him at home, trying to ask him why his organization covers up child abuse.
Mr. Morris?
This guy's word is law to 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses, so it's weird to see him just walking down the street. He sees me coming and crosses the street to get away. When I catch up to him, I'm out of breath.
Mr. Morris? Excuse me, Mr. Morris?
I don't know you.
I know you don't. My name's Trey Bundy. I'm a reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Yeah.
I've been writing stories and producing radio stories this year about Jehovah's Witnesses and child sex abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a second to talk to me?
Not really. I'm going out to preach the good news of the kingdom.
Okay. I saw that you...
He had just released a video where he blames child abuse on homosexuals. I asked him about that.
Can you talk to me about that at all?
It's all in the broadcast.
And with that, someone opens a door to a building a few feet away, and Morris rushes inside. After calling and emailing the governing body for months with no response, after reading through stacks of their documents, after flying from California to New York, I finally find one of these guys, and seconds later, he's gone. Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the governing body are anointed, that they're God's channel to followers on earth. And Howie knew these guys as people. Like Carl Klein, the governing body member in the wheelchair, Howie was with him the day his faith began to unravel. He was reading a letter to Klein from a Jehovah's Witness disputing some of the religion's key tenets.
And I thought, for sure, you know, he'd want me to shred it, and the shredder was right there next to his desk, because, you know, this is apostate stuff for sure.
Apostates are enemies of the religion. Jehovah's Witnesses believe they're controlled by Satan. Howie says he and Klein took the letter straight to Bethel's librarian.
Not for destruction, but for archiving.
The librarian took the letter to a small locked room.
And in this room were partially filled bookshelves. And it was a small apostate library. And here they kept for reference the various publications of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that they viewed as apostates.
Howie freaked out. There was almost nothing worse a Jehovah's Witness could do than read the writing of an apostate.
What if our belief system isn't ironclad, as I've always believed? You know, what if we're wrong about the new world? What if I am waiting for a cure that does not exist? Well, wouldn't that be sad? Because I've wasted my life. Leaving Bethel meant losing my job and losing my home. So it was a struggle at first. And then, of course, when I disassociated myself a few months later, it meant losing my family and all of my friends. and so I was alone, and I had to prepare myself, and it took time.
The next time I meet Howie, we're in his backyard. He lives in New Jersey now, with his husband and their two kids. A fall breeze hits the wind chimes, and Howie pushes the kids in their little plastic cars. They run around the garden and stomp on brown leaves in the driveway. He says he feels for people who never left the Jehovah's Witnesses.
My concern is that there's a lot of people wrapped up in this, up in this religion, and they're doing what I did. They're wasting their lives. And as the years go by and the hoped for promises are not realized, they may eventually get discouraged and leave, or they may just hang with it because they feel or are afraid they have nowhere else to go.
Over the last few years, the Jehovah's Witnesses have been selling off their Brooklyn properties and building a massive compound in Warwick, a small town in upstate New York. They plan to move their headquarters completely out of Brooklyn sometime before 2018. Up next, Trey heads to England, home to more than 100,000 Jehovah's Witnesses, and he finds a familiar pattern.
I mean, I think that, true to form, the Watchtower is putting up obstructions at every possible turn to refuse to turn over documents.
Next on Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. All this episode, we followed reporter Trey Bundy as he's tried to track down this database that the Jehovah's Witnesses are keeping under wraps. Information that could reveal thousands of child sex abusers around the country. Jehovah's Witness leaders at the Watchtower won't talk to Trey, and they've refused to comply with court orders to hand over their child abuse files. But if authorities know that the Watchtower has these files, why can't the FBI or police just storm the headquarters and take them? Trey joins us now to talk about that. Hey, Trey.
Hello, Al.
So before we get into the role of the authorities in uncovering this information, tell me a little bit about how the Jehovah's Witnesses justify keeping this information secret.
So the Jehovah's Witnesses base all of their child abuse policies on scripture. They say all of this comes from the Bible. So, for example, the so-called two-witness rule. They say that nobody's reputation should be ruined. Nobody should go to prison at the testimony of just a single witness. So when they hear an allegation of child abuse, if there's not two witnesses to that crime, they don't do anything about it.
That's so problematic. I mean, usually if someone's being abused, there is no two witnesses. It's just one person.
Right. This is a crime that almost always happens behind closed doors, almost always happens in secret, and that people don't talk about until they're much, much older. So that means that most of these cases, the vast majority of these cases, don't even reach the level where an elder is going to punish the abuser in the organization, much less call the police.
So even though the Jehovah's Witnesses won't report these abusers, they do keep track of them, which just seems odd that they have all this information, but they won't turn it over. So how can this information just be sitting there? Like, we know it's there and no one is doing anything about it.
The real question is, where's law enforcement? You know, it would seem like the FBI or the police would be able to get a search warrant and go in. But I've talked to a lot of lawyers about this, and they all say basically the same thing. All the cases that we've talked about, and most of the cases of Jehovah's Witnesses in court, are civil cases. If there were a criminal prosecution, then maybe a prosecutor could ask for these documents, and if they didn't give them up, then law enforcement could jump in with a search warrant. But there's almost no prosecutions of these abusers because the Jehovah's Witnesses don't report them.
Now, we heard earlier in the show how frustrating this has been for Erwin Zalkin, the lawyer who's been bringing a bunch of civil cases against the Jehovah's Witnesses. But I'm curious, how frustrating is this for you as a reporter?
This case has, you know, I've been looking at this for 2 years, and that's a long time to know what's out there and to not be able to actually, you know, get my hands on it and see it for myself. You know, we're talking about the names of possibly thousands of child abusers, you know, knowing that kids are out there that could be in danger from these people. It definitely gives us a sense of urgency, and that's why we're still reporting the story.
So the Jehovah's Witnesses are a worldwide organization, but Other countries have been pretty aggressive, namely Australia and the UK. They've really tried to hold them accountable. Recently, you went to England to report on this, so why don't you pick up the story from there?
So what's different in England from the US is that there's an actual government agency there that's investigating their policies, and the issue's gotten national news coverage.
They knock on our doors, but what's happening behind theirs? Britain's Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the end times are coming. But could their financial doomsday come first, as child abuse victims hold them to account?
I now feel the only way to get the Jehovah's Witnesses to look at their policies and to change it for the better is by taking them to court. And hopefully that way they may then have to think maybe it's time for us to change our policies.
The agency I mentioned is called the Charity Commission for England and Wales. It opened an investigation in 2014 and requested documents from the Watchtower's London branch, but they refused to hand them over. I talked to Chris Willis Pickup, an attorney for the Charity Commission.
How many motions has the Watchtower filed to stop the investigation and dispute the production of documents?
So we've been in 5 different courts so far to defend our decisions.
The Charity Commission investigates organizations to make sure they're in compliance with charity laws. But they have limited power. They can't kick down doors and take documents like law enforcement can.
I think that, true to form, the Watchtower is putting up obstructions at every possible turn to refuse to turn over documents.
That's Kathleen Hallisey. She's an American lawyer living in London who's handled more Jehovah's Witness cases than anyone in England. She won a high-profile lawsuit last year, in part because the Jehovah's Witnesses gave up documents proving the accused had abused before.
However, in my more recent cases, they're refusing to really turn over any documents whatsoever.
It's the same strategy that we see here in the U.S. The Jehovah's Witnesses will sometimes hand over documents in court related to a single victim, but the vast majority of documents are still locked away, and they could lead authorities directly to predators, people who could still be abusing kids. Kathleen says that lack of transparency and the Jehovah's Witnesses' separatist attitude toward society make the religion a perfect environment for child abusers.
Limited interaction with the outside world. There's a real emphasis on not engaging with secular authorities. So the conditions are ripe for abuse, and predators are purposeful. And I think that they choose those types of environments very carefully, where they know they can operate with impunity. Unfortunately, the policies of the Watchtower allow them to continue to do that again and again and again.
While the commission in England hasn't released its findings, a government commission in Australia has had some success. After the Catholic Church scandal, they started looking at abuse within other religious organizations. Last year, the commission held public hearings on the Jehovah's Witnesses. Here's a Jehovah's Witness elder answering questions about their policies.
What ability have we got to protect every child in Australia?
Well, what you can do is you can report to the child protection authorities.
And that is done in some cases.
But generally it's not done, is it?
No.
It's not done unless there's a legal requirement for it to be done, is there?
That is true.
Investigators in Australia turned up more than 1,000 alleged abusers. None of those cases had been reported to authorities, but the commission has referred 700 of them to police. The kind of government investigations happening in the UK and Australia, we haven't seen anything like that here in the US. And that drives Erwin Zalkin crazy. He's the San Diego lawyer we met at the beginning of the show who represents child abuse victims. He thinks law enforcement has a moral obligation to force the Jehovah's Witnesses to hand over their documents that identify alleged child abusers. As we said earlier, Erwin did get some of those documents, 4 years worth of Jehovah's Witness child abuse files, but a judge has ordered him to keep them secret. So?
We keep the materials locked up in that cabinet.
And you can't show them to me?
No, I can't show them to you.
Why not?
Because it would violate the terms of that protective order, I think.
If the cops came in here and they didn't have a warrant, you couldn't show them either.
Yeah, I probably would not show them that. Right. They would not be able to, unless they could break into this cabinet. They wouldn't get them.
Right. These are going to stay locked up. They're going to stay secret. They're going to stay redacted.
For the time being, yes.
The Jehovah's Witnesses have refused to do an interview with us. The only thing they gave us was a written statement last year saying they abhor child abuse and comply with all child abuse reporting laws. Meanwhile, they're just sitting on a database that likely contains the names of thousands of predators who could still be abusing kids to this day. Trey Bundy produced and reported today's show. He's been on this story for about 2 years. Now, if you want to see what it's like to be in a reporter's shoes, you can check out a virtual reality project he put together as he was reporting on this show. You can find that at revealnews.org. You can also check out what we're covering by liking us on Facebook or following us on Twitter. We're at Reveal, and I'm Al_Letson. Her Money with Jean Chatsky is a weekly podcast created to empower women to live better by focusing on their finances. Whether you're a woman yourself, which I'm not, or you have a woman in your life who you care about, which I do, you should check this one out. Her Money features great interviews with inspiring women from Gretchen Rubin to Arianna Huffington. It's a place to learn about earning more, saving more, investing wisely, and building the financial life you want. You can find Her Money on iTunes, Stitcher, or JeanChatsky.com. Our show today was edited by Annie Donahue. Our staff includes Stan Alcorn, Fernanda Camarena, Julia B. Chan, Rachel DeLeon, Mwenda Hasey, Emily Harris, Catherine Miskowski, Michael Montgomery, David Richard, Nina Satija, Michael Schiller, Ike Shrieskandaraja, Laura Starcheski, and Amy Walters. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen, with extra help from Peter Kahnheim. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor. And our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.